You're listening to the Big Three of B2B Leadership Podcast with Mike Faherty, where world-class business leaders share their secrets for personal, organizational, and market growth. Gain powerful insights from industry leaders that have been tested by the fire.
Hello, welcome everyone. Welcome back to the Big Three of B2B Leadership. My name is Mike Faherty. I'm your host today. And today, I've got the pleasure of being joined by Diana Ritchie. So Diana is the VP of Client Engagement at Advancing Global EDU. Diana and I have known each other for 20 plus years. We've run in some of the same circles around education technology for the last couple of decades, and she's an incredibly valuable resource to me, and I'm sure you guys are really going to enjoy what she has to share with you about her insight and experience working in ed tech and working with some fascinating companies that you've heard of in their education marketing divisions like Hewlett-Packard, Oracle, and then some other very specific ed tech companies like Fuel Education, Knowledge Delivery Systems, and others. And so I'm really excited to have Diana here to talk really specifically about one particular market segment, and that's really K-12 and to some extent maybe higher ed as it's relevant, but it's a fascinating market and it's a very unique market in a lot of ways. And so we're going to kind of get into some of that today, but really pleased to have you. Thanks so much for joining, Diana.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, Diana, I'm really excited to have you, and I'm really excited to have this conversation about education. And I know when I was preparing for this call today, I was reminded that you had started your career in the classroom, that you'd started out as an English teacher. So I was hoping maybe you could talk a little bit about your decision to go into education in general and kind of how that led to where you are now.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. So I would say to be honest, my real reason for going into education initially was that I just took too many classes at the University of Texas. I really enjoyed school so much that I finally realized at some point that, you know, I had to graduate, I had to do something, and so I decided to go into teaching. How that drove me into ed tech was that I was an English teacher really struggling to personalize learning for my kids. And at the school where I taught were a bunch of computers, Apple computers, sitting in boxes that nobody was using. And so I basically told this principal that I knew how to run a computer lab. So he put me in charge, and I kind of figured it out along the way. But one of the things I learned was that it really did give me the opportunity to start individualizing instruction, getting kids to take a little more ownership of their own learning. And that got me excited about the whole education technology space and the opportunity there.
That's really interesting. Look, you know, there were a lot during that time, there were a lot of schools that were buying a lot of technology and had no idea how to implement it. And they weren't really sure, as you know, they weren't really sure how to quantify whether or not they were having an impact or not. They just knew they should have been doing it. And it's funny, here we are 20, 25 years later. And that's still the case in a lot of organizations, right? They're still trying to figure out how do we get a handle on whether or not technology investments are really having an impact on student achievement. What do you think? Do you think we're making progress there, or do you think we still have a long way to go?
You know, I would say it's really a mixed bag. I mean, I expected technology to transform education faster than it did. My expectation was that by now we would have moved past the need for grades, the needs for these high stakes assessments that all the kids have to take, you know, move past the need for seat time requirements. So how much time you're actually sitting on your butt listening to instruction, and really move to a competency-based approach that I think technology really facilitates, allowing you to kind of move at your own pace, and to focus on things, you know, your skill gaps, cover up those skill gaps, but also move forward much, much more quickly. I think in some ways that hasn't happened because people are slow to adapt. However, you know, I wouldn't blame it all on the education system. I would say some of this has to do with legislation. So if you think about federal legislation, the requirement for certain assessments. If you think about how school districts are funded with attendance money, and what does that mean? What does attendance mean when kids are learning virtually? You know, when they could be learning at 2 o'clock in the morning. How do you count that they're really present? And so that's something I think that the pandemic has really accelerated for us, is this move to online learning.
So, you know, obviously this, the focus of this, of our discussions on this podcast have been around business and business growth. And something you know a lot about, you've led a lot of sales and marketing organizations over the years. I really love your thoughts on how you think the K-12 market is maybe different or unique to a more traditional or a corporate or commercial B2B market. It's B2B, obviously, but how do you think K-12 is different than a typical B2B organization?
Okay. Well, you know, first, I think I should start by saying that anyone who is interested in getting into the K-12 space, or even if you are selling products and services into K-12, it's very important that you're sensitive to this particular point in history and what's happening to schools today. When you approach them, you need to understand that they're really struggling right now. Not only were they, even though they were using technology to some degree, they were not ready for the most part for having moving technology into kids' homes, having their teachers work remotely and suddenly have to learn how to teach that way, and their staff as well, you know, having their employees work from home. They were just were not ready for that. So this has been a real challenge for them. And what's happened, I think, that's really unfortunate is this has really shown a big light on the inequity in education. So, you know, there's a lot of folks like you and me, maybe, who had kids at home, and it was a struggle for everyone to try to take time off work or work from home and support their kids. But if you were somewhat affluent, you could handle it fairly well, right? I mean, you had the ability to have technology for your kids at home if they needed it. You could hire online tutors. But if you think about a lot of people out there who have to go out and work, you know, in the workplace, and their kids were at home by themselves, they were really struggling. And many of them did not have technology at home. Even if the school gave them a device, they didn't have internet. So it really hurt those kids. And when you think about special needs students or English learners, our homeless students, I mean, they have really fallen behind. I mean, a lot of organizations out there believe that a lot of students have lost maybe a year of learning because of this. So I think we have to be sensitive to that as, you know, when you're approaching schools, I think that's important. And I think it's especially important because this really is a relationship business. You know, if you go into this market believing that, you have great data to show that your product works and that's all you need. That is important, but you have to understand that a lot of decisions are made based on recommendations from peers, right? And Mike, I know that you've done business in this market as well, and having referrals, having references, having case studies where school district leaders can point, you know that their peers out there have said that this is a great product and service and works for them. That is incredibly important in this space. I mean, those are a couple of things. I mean, I don't know. Do you want to talk about how complex the sales cycle is sometimes and why?
Let's talk about that, because I recognize that social proof in this space is really, really valuable. And no one wants to, there's a lot at stake, right? We used to work where guys said, we're not helping Pizza Hut make more pizzas, right? You might remember those comments. And because we're really trying to help people improve our economy, our society, it's massively important, the work that schools do. And so so there's a risk aversion because of that. There's a methodical sort of thought process, and they're interested in only trying things that they know have worked because they can't afford to make a mistake. Not only they can't afford to make a mistake because of what's at stake from a student achievement standpoint and a student development standpoint, but also a lot of these people are political. You know, they can't afford to make a mistake because they lose their job because they made a mistake. If they bet on the technology or they bet on an initiative or a program and it fails, there's a lot at stake for them personally. And we know that buying decisions are often made first as a personal decision and then ultimately as they try to rationalize that with an ROI calculation at some point, right? But you mentioned the sales cycle, and it is really, really unique. The only thing I liken it to is, the only thing that's like it in my mind, I want your thoughts on this, is the seasonality around Christmas, right? There is a very clear, if you're a retailer, you know that you're going to make your money in the last 2 months of the year. And that's just how the world works. And so everything is aligning to those sorts of dates and those timelines. It's the only thing I think is similar to K-12. Talk a little bit about how K-12, how they make the buying decisions and when those things happen and what's important for someone who's maybe thinking about entering the K-12 market to really understand.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, first I would say that, the normal sales cycle for K-12 this past year was really disrupted, right?
Right.
So if you think about, kind of that, time frame in spring when the pandemic hit, school districts were already way down the path of having done their needs assessment and all of that really even before the winter break. And then really it's the rest of the school year that they are really planning for, releasing RFPs, for example, releasing RFIs, going through the process of selecting, often through committees, right, what products and services are going to buy before the end of June so that they can have them implemented and ready to go at the beginning of the school year. And think about what happened, right? Suddenly, you have to change your budgeting priorities. You have to say, hey, I have to go out now and buy devices for kids. I got to buy hotspots for kids. I have to think about how I'm going to support all this technology, right? I mean, I'm going to probably need people to not only help me track these assets, but oh my gosh, I'm going to have somebody with tech support, to help all these parents and kids at home. They still have to feed kids. How are you going to get food to kids who otherwise aren't going to eat? That's a real logistical issue, but also involved a budgeting cycle. Learning management systems. I don't know that I would consider Zoom a learning management system, but that is one provider that districts will end up using, right? So it changed how they bought, and what's happened as a result is a lot of funds have been obligated that even haven't been spent yet just to pay for those kinds of things. But in a normal cycle, let's pretend like it was a normal year. I mean, how it works, right? So typically it might start with a needs assessment during the first part of the school year. What do we really need for next school year? What types of products and services are going to help us accomplish our goals that we set out? And then you're really going to start investigating and researching them. And you and I know that a lot of that research is done asking colleagues, right? In the past, going to conferences, seeing what's out there. They do a lot of research online, so you better have a good website, right? They watch webinars, inbound marketing efforts really help there. So that typically after winter break, they kind of sort of know what they want, right? Even if they go through an RFP process. And then funds really need to be spent by the end of June so that they can be implemented over the summer, and then, you can kind of start the process over. So is that kind of what you've seen as well?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the typical flow. There's when we're working with clients who are trying to grow into this space, we talk about fall really being about lead development. It's just about building awareness and generating leads and starting the engagement process. And then as we take them through winter, we're trying to we're trying to give them the information they need so they can make the buying decisions. That's where the case studies and the proof points come in. It's where the demos and the trials and things like that might be happening, is when we get into that winter and early spring. And by the time we get into the full-blown spring, it's time to start making buying decisions. And that's when quotes start going out. That's when pricing begins, negotiations might start at that point. Then the summer is harvest season, as we used to call it, right? So that's when everything gets implemented. It's when the orders are cut and things need to be delivered, because they need to get it in place and operational before the fall of the next year. So it is an unusual pattern, but it's very predictable. And where I see organizations make mistakes sometimes, they don't appreciate that seasonality and that flow to it. And they're trying to get quotes whenever they should be generating leads, and they're trying to generate leads when they should be negotiating pricing. And if you can align your process with their buying process, right? That's why we spend time talking about the customer's journey and how buyers make decisions. It's really important to understand that. So that's pretty awesome. Thanks for sharing that. So you talked a little bit about this mass virtualization or the remote learning that's going on right now. And this has been going on now, as we sit here in end of October, virtually 10 months. So what are some of the priorities that you see the organizations trying to address? Support for the technology is certainly one. Getting technology in the hands of the students who need it is certainly, those are kind of givens. What are some of the other challenges or priorities that you see organizations trying to address from when it comes to virtual or remote learning?
Yeah, I mean, so I think what you've seen happen, Mike, is there are specific things that are having to happen now, and immediately during COVID that really shifted the market. I mean, we've seen big companies conduct major layoffs and really be losers in this space, and then others really be winners. And it's kind of fascinating. A lot of it does have to do with what problems they're solving. So, for example, think about student engagement during this time and the need to address the learning loss and what products and services are important there. So you've got the big traditional publishers that have not been doing very well. School districts are not necessarily out buying core curriculum, in the way that they would be doing. Instead, what you're seeing is them looking at the kinds of online learning solutions or hybrid solutions that are going to help them remediate that learning loss. And so in this new space, we've seen some really exciting things happen. We've seen a lot of progress in the area of gamifications, for example, which gets kids excited and engaged in learning, but also allows for assessment to happen while kids are learning, which is really important. So you're also seeing those big high stakes formative assessment companies not doing as well. Or summative assessments, I'm sorry. What you're really seeing is more formative assessments. So assessments kind of happening all the time, to help kids move forward. Some of the other companies that I think have really suffered are those that provide an in-person type of support, So if a district were outsourcing, let's say, special education supports, you're not seeing those as much anymore. But you are seeing online tutoring companies do really well. If you think about it, that really makes a lot of sense. The other thing I think that you're seeing are, parents are having much more voice, right? So if you think about the learning management system space in education, there are companies that were doing very well that now school districts are looking to maybe replace those solutions because they didn't offer the kind of parent support that was needed. So, it used to be that you didn't feel like you had to really have such a good understanding of what was happening with their child's education, right? And now you want to see those reports. You want to see what, you know, how your son is doing in English, and what is he supposed to know at this time? What skills has he, should he have mastered? You know, and so you're much more engaged. Parents pre-COVID, affluent parents spent maybe $1,000 a year extra helping with their kids' education. Now they're looking at way more than that, right? You've heard about these learning pods that cost in excess of $2,000 a month even. So it's, you know, so the B2C market in that space, I think, is hot as well. So it's, you know, you're really, really seeing that happen, though, to address those issues. Are you seeing that as well?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, of course. That I think that there's you just touched on it, which is really interesting to me, that engaging the parents. If you're providing a curriculum or a software solution, if you haven't stopped to think about how can I enable the parent to either access this information or engage with the software themselves, enable them to be able to support the student as they use the products, and provide assessments to them, maybe at a deeper level or a personal level that you wouldn't necessarily want to come to the school. There's a lot of different ways to think about. I'd be asking the question, what information can we provide to the parents right now? In what ways, how can we get our parents involved, the parents of these students involved in the solution in some way? And I think there's tons of opportunity for there to be upsell and increased revenue opportunities for organizations, just by saying, hey, look, for parents, hey, for $9.99 a month, you can do this other thing with our tool, and you can access it also. Or unlock these tutorials or unlock these capabilities allow you to support your students' learning. I just think the parent side of things is going to become a much bigger opportunity for organizations, and or particularly software and learning applications. One of the things you also said that I really like is this idea of sort of real-time assessments that as the students are engaging with the platform, that it's constantly capturing analytics about the things that they're getting right, the things that they're getting wrong, the things that they spend more time on, or things that take them longer than the average to complete, or that they're doing faster than their peers. As an example, there's tons of insight that can be captured from this that can allow not only the application to fine tune and direct the student towards other resources or games or exercises that can help them support the things that they're struggling with or things that they need more time with, but also give that insight to the teachers and the districts and others who need that information to say, where is there an opportunity for us to improve? And that might be, hey, we need to make an investment in a different application or in a different, we talked about supplemental learning, right? So, hey, I've got these kids that are struggling in this one area. We need to get access to this other tool that will engage them and just give them support in that one thing, just for those kids, right? Just for those students.
Yeah. No, absolutely, absolutely. First of all, parents are absolutely key. They are going to do whatever they can do to help their kids. And there's got to be a way to keep them informed. There's been a lot of thinking about, you know, in the past, informing a parent meant to tell you, you know, what your kid's grade was after 6 weeks or if they were absent too much or things like that, or whether their behavior was acceptable or not. And now I think it's really a process and opportunity to educate kids on the kinds of skills, kind of competencies that your child should have mastered by a certain level. And then help educate you. So we're talking about professional development for parents, not just for teachers, right? So that you know, for example, at home, how can you be helping your son or daughter learn these skills? What kind of things can you do around the house with things that you have that can help them, learn these things? And then in terms of language learning, you see that market taking off significantly, right? So as a parent, you might be in making those own, your investments in having your child learn a second language. Maybe you want to learn it with them. And so I think there's a huge opportunity there. You know, the biggest challenge I think for school districts is going to be, how do we support those kids, you know, whose parents don't have the resources or the time really, you know, to spend with them. And I mean, that is a really significant challenge. And that's why I think that there's a real fight to get kids back into the classroom in many cases, you know, because that is really that in-person kind of interaction is really all that that works with, you know, to support those kids. So that is a challenge too.
Yeah, that's a problem. It's always been a problem, right? It's been a problem since the beginning of, you know, our public education system, is those marginalized or at risk kids getting, they don't get the support that they need at home. And so they, the only instruction they get, the only structure in some cases that they get is what comes in the classroom. And so it's really important. So without that, yeah, you're right. It's a little bit scary, you know, how far behind some of these kids may be drifting. And it has nothing to do with them, right? It will have nothing to do with them. It will have everything to do with their environment and not their aptitude or their ability or their willingness to learn. It's just the environment that we put them in.
Mike, especially now, I mean, imagine you're a parent who's really kind of a first responder, right? You're a nurse or a doctor. You are a restaurant manager, or, you know, back when restaurants reopened, you know, or you're someone who needs to physically be somewhere to do your job, you know, whatever that job happens to be. You're a firefighter, you're a police officer, whatever. I mean, you love your kids, you care about your kids, but you can't be there for your second grader, your third grader. I mean, think about when we had kids that age, how hard that would be.
Yeah.
You know, and so do you put them in childcare where they're not really learning anything? And so, yes, I mean, we definitely have to address that as well.
I love the comment that you made a moment ago, and I had, because it really encapsulated what I think I was trying to say, maybe not so eloquently, is a professional development for parents. I think that's the idea that I think I was trying to communicate, is that there's an opportunity to teach the parents and to give the information, the parents information that they need to help their students, but also to teach the parents how to help their students. And that's what professional development is about. And we know districts spend millions in some cases on teaching their teachers every single year, skill gaps and skills development. They know how important continuing the education process for even their professional teachers who've spent their lifetime, you know, learning how to be a leader of a classroom or in the classroom leading, and they still need to develop these skills. And now you've asked a parent who has none of that experience to suddenly be head of instruction for their child. And it's a lot to ask. It's a lot to ask.
No kidding. You know, and you made me think of something else too. So, you know, I have some friends who are school board members, and you talk about keeping parents engaged and informed. The other challenge is the taxpayers, because in many communities, the folks who actually pay for schools through their, you know, through their tax dollars, and in Texas, a lot of that is your property tax, right? They are calling up school board members saying, hey, kids are at home now. Why do I have to keep paying for school? What the heck are you guys doing? Right? Because they think they're just doing nothing. They're just hanging out at home watching TV. So what can you do? And this really presents an opportunity, right, for organizations that can help school districts really get that word out to their community. You know, keep parents informed, but you also want to keep other community members informed about the importance of supporting education.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we get back to the business side of it for a moment. So how are you recommending K-12 organizations? And what I mean by K-12, I should say, you know, technology companies or any companies that are selling solutions or products or services into the K-12 marketplace. How are you, what are some of the ways that you think they should be, trying to generate demand, building their sales pipelines in a world where the ways that they would normally do this is, have all changed? We know that conferences and trade shows are really big in this space. That's where a lot of that work happens. Those are all gone, at least for a while. And they've been gone for, 6 to 9 months. And so what are some of the other ways you're seeing people successfully reach their market today?
Yeah. So you're right, Mike. I mean, we really miss our conferences because this is a relationship business, right? And that's where we can build relationships with school district folks. So a couple of things. One is conferences are not totally gone. They've just kind of moved to virtual, which does present its own challenges. So, if you think about it, I would still be looking to participate in conferences in that they allow you to see presentations from school district folks where you get to hear about their needs and you get to understand what's happening in the market. It's also an opportunity for you to be presenting virtually with school district leaders. And the lists they provide are pretty valuable. They sometimes allow for that speed dating and interaction, which is important. If you are going to participate in the same way that you would prepare your customers, I know that you've done this, Mike, a really good job, preparing them to maximize their presence at those conferences, you can help them prepare for virtual conferences in some of the same ways. I mean, it's a little trickier, right? You're not going to be able to take them out to dinner or sit down and, have a conversation with them in the hotel lobby. But, there are opportunities for you to get together during these virtual conferences. And some of them are better than others at facilitating that. But then you're right. I mean, a lot of this, the good news is, educators and especially school and district leaders feel very isolated and they really want to learn from their peers. So this presents an opportunity for you in terms of producing webinars, podcasts like you're doing today with me. If you want to get the attention of a school superintendent, you need to be talking in this kind of a format with school superintendents. Or chief academic officers, or chief information officers, or CFOs, or whoever it is your target audience, that's who they want to hear from. And it needs to be less about selling, right? And more about educating. And this can be certainly done through webinars and podcasts and that type of thing, but it can also be done, as you know, through white papers, through, blogs, talking about best practices, sharing information, and if you can do a lot of that marketing where you're actually pulling people to you because they're trying to find the answers and you are really honestly trying to help them, not just promote your own products and services, but really talk about where they can find those answers in the market, I think you'll be so much further ahead. And because in this space, you do not want to be cold calling or just showing up at a school district door if you don't have a relationship with them. That's not going to be a good strategy.
Yeah, I think the way that you approach, I think you said it in the very beginning, to be honest, Diana, you said, look, you have to be sensitive to the challenges they're dealing with at this moment. And so any outreach that you do, whether that be over the phone or via email or through social or through, one-to-many formats like podcasts or webinars, as you mentioned, you have to be empathetic, right? You really need to recognize what the person and those organizations are going through and the struggles that they're dealing with. I would coach anyone to lead their message should lead with recognizing, hey, I recognize that things are different and this is a challenging time. And then offer a way to help with, whether that be through insight or information or knowledge or support, or, you've seen, maybe talk a little bit about what you're seeing from these organizations that have just really blown up over this time period because they offered free trials and they gave their technology or their software or their curriculum away, or at least portions of it, to try to increase engagement. Talk about, have you seen that work? And then what's next? You know, now I've got to make money. So what do I do next?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what I've seen companies do right, number one, is support their customers, right? So maybe shift from, you know, really trying to sell the folks to how can I best support my existing customers, right? You know, what do they need from me now? And it doesn't always have to be free things, you know, but what kind of services can I provide? How can I really help them be successful now in this challenging environment? In terms of pilots, I have kind of specific thoughts on that. You know, you're right. I mean, in this environment, sometimes you have no choice, especially if you're new or, you know, especially if we're trying to get into maybe a big district to offer some kind of a pilot. I think you have to be really thoughtful about that. And you have to really set it up in a way that you could be successful. So one of the problems I've seen is people give things away and then they're not valued, or the people that they've given them to just don't really have a lot of influence in the buying process. So ideally, if you're going to give away a product or service, you're working with someone who has some level of authority, who can be your executive sponsor, who values what you're doing, and you set parameters around that pilot, right? You've said, okay, we want to be looking at these key performance indicators. So it's probably not realistic that you're going to dramatically improve student learning. Maybe you will, maybe you won't, you know what I mean? Or save them tons and tons of money during this limited pilot process. But what are those things that you can do that you can prove out through this pilot? And then you have to understand the procurement process, right? I mean, do not go into this space thinking that procurement isn't complex in K-12, right? So, and if you're going to try to sell something, especially anything over $25,000, they're probably going to have to go through some evaluation process, right? RFP, RFI. So know all that in your pilot process. Maybe float a sample contract out there for procurement to look at. You know, have your ducks in a row so that you can move forward. You know, I think that's key. Some other things to think about. We talked a lot about instruction, but a lot of what school districts need now are ways to save money. So if you think about the business or operational side, think about how much energy, for example, school districts use. And if you could come in and help them by saying, look, what if I can help you? You know, for example, to get kids back into school, you're going to have to improve your ventilation system. You know, we've heard that, right? That schools have really old ventilation, that, you know, it's very dangerous to kids. This helps spread disease. So we need to improve ventilation. Well, that costs money. Well, what if you could pay for that through other things that you might do to save energy, right? You know, getting LED light bulbs, for example, or, you know, doing things like installing solar panels. You know, and, you know, are those things like that you could do to save the money? If you're on the ERP side, financial HR payroll side, what can you be doing to save the money there? You know, so, and really, you know, are you going to be providing other services to help them be successful?
Yeah,
I would say I'd be looking at that.
No, I think that's a really great suggestion. I think it's always sound business to look at what are the investments that a customer is going to have to make just before or just after they deal with my solution, after they do business with me. They needed something probably right before and they needed something right after. So looking at how can I partner strategically with the people that are doing business with my same customer just maybe right before or right after, or in some tangential way, that that I can either strategically partner with them, we can bundle our services together so there's an overall more compelling ROI. Just thinking more creatively about partnerships right now is probably really wise advice. So I can appreciate that. Well, look, I could talk about this stuff all day with you, Diana. Fascinating. As you know, this is one of my favorite markets. We do a lot of work in this space for ed tech companies and helping them penetrate this space. And you've been a mainstay in this market for a long time. And so I'm grateful for you spending a few minutes with me today, talking on the big three of B2B leadership and talking about growth, and specifically in the K-12 space and certainly in the climate that we're in right now. Your insight is extremely valuable. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Mike. I loved it. It was fun.
That's awesome.
Appreciate it.
Well, look, folks, if you enjoyed what you heard today and you're enjoying listening to the big three of B2B leadership, then I'd really be grateful if you take a moment and like our content, like the podcast, give us a 5-star review, leave a review, tell us what you think of it. It's really, really important to us. We want to continue to bring really insightful conversations like this to everyone on a weekly basis. So thank you for your support. Thank you for continuing to listen. And thank you for sharing this with your other folks that are maybe looking to do business in the K-12 space or already doing business in that market. Please share this content. There was a lot of really, really insightful commentary from Diana today. So you know, when we wrap these things up, we always remind you that companies grow faster when they focus on the big three of B2B leadership. Thanks so much, and everyone have a great day.
Pro Sales Connection is a sales and marketing firm that has been helping B2B companies grow faster since 2009. Learn more about our proprietary fastest path to revenue process for B2B companies. Experiencing the possibilities begins with a short 15-minute call. Schedule yours at www.prosalesconnection.com and click Get Started.